all of us on this panel are engaged in some form or another in research having to do with marriage, and it testifies to the great boom in 16th century sex. There are some common denominators among members of the panel this morning. At least three of the persons have done work with Professor Robert Kingdon at one stage in their career or another, which would make it plausible for Professor Kingdon to have moderated this session instead of myself. Three of the members are recent PhDs or in the process of completing their PhDs. Ethicists have a good deal of concern with the way historians treat the subject of marriage and the family as other subjects such as contraception and war, and they claim that when we bring insight, historical insight, historical understanding to questions of this nature, that we are left with a position of extreme relativism, and so they challenge us to find universality in historicity, and so maybe we can attempt to do that today. The first paper that we have this morning will be presented by Professor Thomas F. Miller. Professor Miller will receive his PhD this spring from the University of Virginia. He received an MA from University of Iowa under Professor Kingdon and a BA at Illinois State University. He's presently teaching at Wisconsin State University at Eau Claire. Professor Miller.
First of all, let me say that like a number of others, I seem to have contracted a cold while I have been in St. Louis, so I hope that that will not detract from my presentation. One of the more attractive of the second generation of Lutheran reformers is Cyriacus Spangenberg, who lived from 1528 to 1604. A pastor, a member of the Gnasio-Lutheran faction in the Lutheran orthodoxy struggles of the second half of the 16th century, and a prolific author, Spangenberg was deeply involved with the important questions in his day. Like many of his Lutheran colleagues, Spangenberg wrote on marriage in his Haustafel of 1558 and much longer Eheschwegel of 1570. These works are especially valuable to the historian attempting to understand the attitude of the Lutheran clergy toward marriage and the family, not only because of the length and extensive treatment of the subject, but also because of the author's practical turn of mind. Spangenberg is useful not simply because he wrote so much, but because so much of what he wrote is unusually informative and perceptive. He wrote as a pastor, from a pastor's perspective, trying to understand the problems of his flock. More than many of his contemporaries, Spangenberg seemed to have a genuine understanding for and appreciation of the situation of his parishioners. He offers the historian an often engaging view of the relationships which constituted the 16th century German Lutheran family. In some respects, Spangenberg's view of marriage relationships appears to be unremarkable and indeed pedestrian. For instance, he said that marriage was an estate in which the husband was the master, which of course one would expect him to say in the 16th century. He said, quote, for instance, "The man in this estate should be the lord and ruler." Husbands, he said, were responsible to govern their wives so that the woman, as the weaker vessel as the Bible indicates, did not fall into improper or impure practices. In the Haustafel, for example, Spangenberg advised the husband about what to do if his spouse persisted in evil actions despite his protestations. He would have to tell her, quote, "Dear wife, I have implored you and admonished you that you must abandon your vice, but neither request nor admonition helps. So if you will not obey willingly, I must take other measures that you will not like." He did not specify either the vices or the corrective measures, but the threat was certainly clear. While this and other similar characterizations seem to indicate a view of the role of the sexes in matrimony that was neither very original nor very perceptive, it is significant that Spangenberg more generally deviated from this position. He recognized that marriage was considerably more complex, and he did not always construe the roles of the spouses so rigidly. For one thing, while Spangenberg believed that the husband was the head of the house, he also believed that that headship should be responsible and restrained. God had, he said, ordained man to be what he called the head and director of the household, not a tyrant and tormentor. More importantly, Spangenberg recognized that there was an affective bond between husband and wife. He noted that if a married person had a pleasant experience, ate or drank something good, he or she wanted the spouse there to enjoy it as well. Marriage was an association, he said, which existed not with troubles and annoyances, but rather in peace, calm, pleasant ease, and happiness. In this association, Spangenberg believed that deep mutual affection played an important role. He said that a husband was supposed to love his wife more than anything else on earth, while he was to be the object of his wife's deepest affection. He defined marriage as, quote, a constant association of hearts, unquote, and said that if it were ended by the death of either the husband or the wife, there was no greater sorrow of the heart possible for a pious Christian. In a manner typical of his practical approach, Spangenberg also suggested to spouses specific actions which would help ensure the growth of love and devotion between them. He told them to remember that they had left their parents and that after marriage they were to be completely loyal to each other. This love could not be passive, but required effort to learn and use means to strengthen it. He warned them not to extol other members of the opposite sex too highly. Particularly if the marriage were the second for either, the first spouse was not to be praised too highly. The wife should always be the most beautiful woman in her husband's eyes, and he the most handsome of men to her. Thus, Spangenberg believed that the nurture and growth of affection in marriage required that spouses be careful not to harm or thwart tender feelings between them. They should use common sense in encouraging the development of proper devotion. Spangenberg also observed several problems which could arise within marriage. His discussion of these problems reinforces the image of his practical view of matrimony, which was not simply rigidly shaped by stereotypes. Spangenberg recognized, for instance, that mistrust could be a serious problem in marriage. He suggested practical circumstances which contributed to such difficulties. An idle tongue, for instance, might arouse a suspicion in a husband's mind. Spangenberg admitted that there might upon occasion be grounds for a husband to distrust his wife, but he warned men to avoid such distrust without good reason. Distrust was associated with other similar feelings. Spangenberg saw clearly a connection with jealousy, for he believed that the two were linked as mutual cause and effect. Spangenberg may not always have reflected accurately his listeners' beliefs or their actions, nor may he have influenced them to the degree that he no doubt wished. He did, however, often display a practical and sensible grasp of human emotions. This example is one of those occasions, as he warned husbands and wives not to watch one another too carefully. Such close and critical observation could easily lead to disastrous misinterpretations, so that an innocent act of friendship, for instance, was construed into a sign of infidelity. Other problems in marriage, Spangenberg suggested, develop from a lack of understanding. He described some practical difficulties. Some spouses were simply not closely enough in tune with each other's needs and interests. Others did not display enough patience with one another and needed to be more understanding and sympathetic. He warned that a wife was not always sufficiently sensitive to her husband's moods. Perhaps she was frivolous when he was serious, or irritated him by the wrong choice of words. But husbands could also be out of harmony with their wives' feelings. For example, they were sometimes determined to do something which their wives completely opposed. Spangenberg's comments consistently suggest that he believed that marriage was an emotional union and that husbands and wives needed to be carefully attuned to their opposite number's emotional and mental state. If they were not, even more serious problems might arise. He charged, for instance, that marital relations could deteriorate into arguing or even fighting. Spouses sometimes used evil words and spoke to each other in harsh tones. Such things were damaging to marriage, for by such means, he said, quote, the hearts become embittered at each other, unquote. The origin of such discord thus resided in a failure of the emotional union. Spangenberg also recognized that marriage sometimes suffered from practical problems which could also have emotional overtones. He noted that one of the most onerous burdens in marriage was the illness of one spouse or the other. Obviously, physical incapacity was of great significance, for in the marital arrangements which Spangenberg described, each partner had specific, well-defined duties. The husband who was ill could not adequately support his wife and children. Of course, support was the principal duty, responsibility which the husband had in a material sense. A sick wife could not perform all of her domestic tasks, and Spangenberg spent a good deal of time describing precisely what those domestic tasks were. Beyond such mundane difficulties, however, lay a more profound one intertwined with the sentiments. The fact that the beloved wife or husband was sick brought unhappiness and concern to the other partner. The emotional closeness of the spouses ensured that the illness of one would be reflected in the concern of the other. Spangenberg also described other kinds of difficulties brought on by financial problems and related concerns about material goods. A partnership like marriage produced cares over financial and material matters which reflected more purely emotional aspects of the relationship. Vexation about material things was rarely independent of the emotional strife, according to Spangenberg. He pointed out that debt, for instance, opened gulfs between husband and wife, which contributed to dissension and dissatisfaction with each other. On the other hand, too much wealth, too many possessions, and the efforts to gain more and more could have the same effect, dissent and emotional turmoil. He warned that marital attraction based on material things was shallow. Like a fire built of straw, he said, it would ignite quickly, burn brightly, but soon die out. A similar connection between the emotional and material realms is evident in Spangenberg's analysis of other factors which might complicate a marriage. Parents, for example, cause problems for their children by interfering in their marriages. He warned that parents exhibited one form of meddling when they exerted pressure on their child to marry a specific person. Such influence was dangerous, for the emotions could not be forced. Parents, no doubt, did not always take this advice. For instance, Spangenberg stated that children of tender years were sometimes contracted to marriage by unfeeling parents. They would then grow up married to someone whom they did not love, and the relationship would come to what Spangenberg termed a terrible end. A couple forced into an unwanted union suffered eternal hell, and no Christian parents, he said, should ever have placed their children in such a horrible predicament. Spangenberg also accused some parents of causing disruption in marriage by interference after it had been solemnized. His view was that marriage defined an emotional jurisdiction whose boundaries were inviolate. A husband and wife established an emotional established a household within whose walls others might live, but the basic emotional unit was the couple. He warned parents who lived with their married children not to interfere in their offspring's marriage. And according to the historical demographers, such intergenerational households were not uncommon, but neither were they typical. But they were certainly something that 16th century people were familiar with. Spangenberg apparently recognized, however, that his suggestions were frequently not heeded. He said that this advice was sometimes hard to follow because the parents' own feelings were deeply involved. He indicated that some parents who attempted to intervene in the marriages of their children were themselves moved by emotional attachments. For example, they became jealous of the child's spouse, Perhaps they thought that their son loved his wife more than he loved them, forgetting the basic principles which were supposed to govern marriage. In Spangenberg's analysis, if love of spouse and love of parents came into conflict, the former was primary. Spangenberg recognized that the emotional interests of married children could be different from and potentially antithetical to those of their parents. He was an exponent of the emotional indivisibility of the nuclear family. Modern discussions of family structure in this period often seem to neglect this emotional component, the importance of which, in Spangenberg's estimation, outweighed that of the physical living arrangements. Spangenberg also noted that emotional problems in marriage could be exacerbated by second marriages. A rather large proportion of the population had probably been married at least twice, so this possibility was of more than academic interest. For example, Peter Laslett says, for England in the 17th century, roughly one quarter of all marriages were at least second marriages. And one famous study which he did, 39% of all the couples living in one English village included at least one spouse who had been previously married. And indeed, Spangenberg himself and Eyspiegel observed that, quote, very often, unquote, one or both of the partners in a marriage were married for the second time. In any event, one problem which he perceived was the presence of stepchildren. In his view, the wicked stepmother was not a figure necessarily limited to nursery stories. Quote, the stepfather and especially the stepmother are commonly accustomed to be proud and defiant if they are of better birth than the poor orphan's deceased parent, or if they bring more property to the husband than the previous wife had. While this specific problem could be present only in second marriages, in Spangenberg's analysis, its cause was more basic. Wickedness to one's stepchildren violated some fundamental laws of marital relations. Since husband and wife became one flesh upon their marriage, an improper relationship between either of them and their stepchildren was a sin against nature. Even more, he said, the preservation of an affection between the spouses was fundamentally important, but was impossible if the children of either were not loved as well. The matter of children in a second marriage illustrates another aspect of Spangenberg's image of marriage as an emotional unit. Children in marriage strengthened and reaffirmed the emotional aspects of matrimony. This role of children was implicit in some of Spangenberg's advice to couples who did not have children of their own. In the first place, he told them that they should beseech the Lord in faith and humility while remembering that only God was ultimately responsible for the gift of children. Always a realist, however, Spangenberg recognized that some might not have children despite their prayers. He told such people that no blame was attached to them, for the divine command to fill the earth through procreation by married people was carried out by others, if not by them. They had not violated God's commandment, as had those who did not want children and had none. He implicitly apparently believed that people were practicing some sort of birth control, at least upon occasion. While this assurance may have satisfied the religious doubts of pious couples, it did not answer their emotional needs. If children were more important than simply a means to an end, albeit a divine end, childless couples must still have felt a void which theological explanation did not fill. Significantly, Spangenberg recognized that need and provided another hope for them. He suggested that they might be able to care for and raise the children of others, perhaps a friend. Neighbor had died, leaving children behind. Couples without children could raise such orphans in godly ways as their own, and by so doing they pleased God greatly and satisfied their own longings. Other evidence shows that Spangenberg believed that the people whom he observed found children to be an important part of their lives. He told parents that they came to understand the reference to a mother's comforting her children in Isaiah 66, 12, and 13 as they played with and entertained their own children. They caught a glimpse of the way their Heavenly Father dealt with them. Spangenberg's purpose in using such a picture was to employ parental love as a means to explain divine love. Because he chose an image which he believed all could understand, he revealed much about the emotional content of family life. Spangenberg's observations of the emotional basis of the family can also be inferred from his consideration of the proper disciplining of children. He held that children should be raised strictly, excuse me, but not cruelly. He lamented that, unfortunately, parents were sometimes uncontrolled in administering discipline. He described several examples of errors which he claimed parents of his time committed. Some parents, especially step-parents, punished children without reason or for the wrong reasons, such as jealousy. Some were unmerciful and impatient with their children and might even express regret that the children had been born. Some cursed and raged at their children. Other parents became besotted with liquor and then scolded the children. Spangenberg condemned such people. He told them that they were wicked and did not act in harmony with the calling God had given them. He demanded that any punishment which parents imposed on their children be exercised with what he called reason. Spangenberg thus condemned those parents who might have been responsible for making pre-modern childhood the hell some recent historians have determined that it must have been. As he observed the people for whom he was writing, moreover, he apparently concluded that the reverse problem was at least as serious. As heinous as excessive discipline was, it was no more of a problem than parents who were too easy with their children. Instead of punishing children who had done wrong, for example, Spangenberg said that parents tried to rationalize and justify their errant actions. Some of them used Paul's advice in Ephesians 6:4 not to provoke one's children to wrath as an excuse not to punish one's children at all. On the contrary, Spangenberg told them, Paul meant that parents had the duty to punish a child who was guilty of a sin such as disobedience. His observation seemed to imply that parents were not simply slothful in exercising discipline over their children, but that they did not want to do so. They looked for reasons to avoid punishing their children. And I might add parenthetically that Spangenberg's colleague and somewhat protege at Mansfeld, Andreas Hoffenroth, maintained that parents did not discipline their children sufficiently because they loved them too much. He made that specific charge. He said they put the love of child over the love of God, who wanted well-disciplined and pious children. Perhaps Spangenberg's most direct discussion of the emotional value of children to their parents is in his consideration of childhood illness or death. From his comments, one must conclude that he thought that parents of children who got hurt or fell ill were enormously concerned or worried. He offered powerful images of such distress. Perhaps he said the child lay burning with fever, racked with pain, or suffering in some other grievous way. When it cried and whimpered so pitifully, quote, that parents' hearts want to break, quote. Parents were apparently not callous to the suffering of small children any more than most modern parents are. They were emotionally attached to their children and evidently had a sympathetic appreciation for childhood. Such concern for children was also manifest when parents faced the death of their offspring, according to Spangenberg. He said that such a death was a tragedy partly because of the loss of a good child. He noted rather mildly that parents might have raised a child to be obedient, pious, and industrious. Such a child might die, however, and that, quote, is not a trifling burden, unquote. He also, only once, offered the comfort for parents not to worry if their child died, for if God had given them one, he would give them more. Such consolation, however, must not have been of great help to parents whose distress at their child's illness Spangenberg had described so graphically. His attitude was more in harmony with what Philippe Ariès, the great historian of childhood, thought to be typical of the medieval outlook. Because so many children died, Ariès suggested that parents were not upset by the death of one more. In this instance, Spangenberg may have stood between the medieval and modern attitudes, better able to observe the concern and grief of parents and to offer consolation for it. He indicated that the death of a child brought enormous grief to the parents. They wept, cried, lamented, and suffered terribly. Only divine consolation could relieve their misery. He told them that they should have remembered that nothing came to pass which is contrary to God's will. Quote, that one grieves as human, that one nevertheless recognizes God's will in such a thing is Christ-like, close quote. Perhaps more consoling to parents was the second point he made. He told them that children who died remained their parents' children. A son who was sent into a distant land remained a son. As he did even more, when he went to what Spangenberg called his dear grandfather, God himself. Parents evidently grieved deeply over their dead children. While Spangenberg did not appear entirely happy with this fact, there was little he could do to change it. He could only try to turn the parents' thoughts to the divine. Children played an important role in the family unit, a role which, according to much of Spangenberg's observations, was basically emotional. This image of children certainly fits with his view of the proper relations between husbands and wives. While Spangenberg was not necessarily typical of his time, and indeed on some important issues such as divorce, differed from his Lutheran co-religionists, his position demonstrates an attitude that is often identified with later periods in the history of the family. In conclusion, I think it's safe to say that judging from Spangenberg's image of family life, historians must be careful not to ascribe to the early modern period a view of the family which is in all ways decisively different from that of modern times.
I forgot to mention that Professor Miller is in the process of completing a dissertation called Mirror for Marriage, Lutheran Views on Marriage and the Family from 1520 to 1600. We'll look forward to the publication of that dissertation. Our next presentation will come from Professor Virginia DeMarsh. She received her BA from the University of Missouri, her MA and PhD from Stanford University. She taught from 1965 to 1972 at Northwest Missouri State, and she's presently teaching at George Mason University.
A nice presentation to back this paper, because we are now moving from the ideal to the real. The proponents of what today is called the traditional family would have found very enthusiastic allies in the ducal bureaucracy of the Duchy of Württemberg in the 16th century. From the reflections that we have in the legal records, it's clear that the ducal bureaucrats envisioned an ideal family. It was based on lifelong monogamous marriage with mutual fidelity of husband and wife. The husband would work hard to support his wife and children. He would behave dutifully to his elderly parents. He would refrain from verbal or physical abuse of his dependents. He would neither drink nor gamble excessively. And in generally, he would behave precisely as a solid citizen should. Reciprocally, in this ideal system, the wife would respectfully obey her husband. The children would obligingly enter the trades to which their father apprenticed them. Young people would never seek to marry without their parents' consent, and indeed, life would proceed in quite undeviating domestic tranquility. As far as one can tell from the legal records, this ideal existed already before Duke Ulrich's introduction of the Reformation in 1534, and doesn't seem to have been significantly affected by it. The series of legal records that I've been using sets in the 1480s is already quite numerous by 1530, and the bureaucrats of Catholic Württemberg were just as committed to this as were the later bureaucrats of Protestant Württemberg, which, considering that many of them were the same people, is not all that surprising. It continued quite undisturbed throughout the religious vicissitudes of the rest of the 16th century. One can define this ideal in the legal records of the duchy more by those cases in which it was absent than by those cases in which it appeared. One of the greatest handicaps in the utilization of the legal records is that they give the researcher very little indication of the extent to which the ideal was really the standard in practice. One has to assume that by definition, those families whose cases reached the court were in some way aberrant. But there is really no way of estimating the proportion of the total that they formed. Even more, there is no way of knowing how many families at this time ran into difficulty but managed in some way to resolve their difficulties without resorting to the courts. The question, for instance, would be, for every wife who showed up and sued her husband for divorce on grounds of his adultery, how many were there who fairly silently accepted a double standard and did not do so? The material that we're looking at in some detail today is drawn from the records of the Ehegericht, or the matrimonial court of the Duchy of Württemberg. To put these records in a little bit of perspective, I want to point out that in the Duchy of Württemberg, various delicts and misdeeds that could occur within the context of the family were prosecuted under the criminal code and regulated by the civil code, as well as by the matrimonial court, the Ehegericht itself. To give you some example, the regulation of matrimonial property and dowries fell under the civil code. The Ehegericht had nothing to do with it. Adultery was a ground for divorce in the Eheordnung, but adultery was also punishable under the Landesordnung. Under Duke Ulrich's 1536 Landesordnung, for example, the first act of adultery drew 4 weeks in prison. The second act of adultery drew 8 weeks in prison with the loss of citizenship rights. And the third act of adultery caused exile. Anyone pardoned for a previous adultery who then repeated the offense was subject to capital punishment. And this had nothing to do with any divorce action that might or might not be brought in the matrimonial court. The secular court also handled cases of assault and murder between spouses, whether or not these were successful. It disposed of instances of sodomy, as well as prostitution, rape, desertion and non-support where neither party was suing for divorce, illegitimacy with or without subsequent infanticide, fornication, bigamy, and various combinations of the above. Those all went into the criminal courts rather than into the Ehegericht. In other words, there was a lot of domestic malfeasance that did not fall within the province of the matrimonial court. There are 7,736 parole bonds of the 16th century surviving in the Württemberg Hauptstaatsarchiv, and of these, 838 fall into the domestic category, generally. There are 58 cases of adultery by a man, 19 cases of adultery by a woman, 2 cases of blood incest, 16 cases of incest under canon law prohibitions, 59 cases of wife beating, 3 cases of husband beating, 14 cases of child abuse, 20 cases of assault on other family members, parents, siblings, and the like, 54 cases dealing with extravagance, waste of family property, 41 cases of desertion, 29 cases of fornication, and 19 cases of bigamy with some overlap in cases of multiple offense. So one can get some sense of what the families of Württemberg were doing. I put rape under assault rather than under domestic offense, except where incense was involved, because the court put rape as an assault rather than as a sexual offense, except where incest was involved. So given this background, we can look at the work of the Ehegericht as a compact body of cases on specifically matrimonial matters. And because they are so compact and relatively parallel, they are of great use. The Ehegericht was established under Duke Ulrich's Eheordnung of 1534-1537. It was continued basically unchanged under the second Eheordnung of January 1st, 1553, and surviving a variety of other Eheordnungen finally vanished in 1806. Now, the surviving documentation is not complete. Between 1541 and 1543, there are only five decisions in the records. From 1548 to 1566, there are only 77 decisions in the records. And we presume that by the time someone in the 1570s sat down and wrote up the surviving records, some of the original material was already lost. However, for the period from 1544 through 1547, and then from 1577 through 1590, there is a total of 3,885 cases. This is probably a complete record for these years. It averages about 139 cases per year heard by the court pretty consistently all the way through. Now, the work of the Ehegericht pertained to certain specific categories of cases. The majority of the cases, slightly, 54%, dealt with people who weren't married, either breach of promise or the invalidation of betrothals that had been contracted. And many of the betrothals that were claimed to exist by one party or the other were found by the court not to exist in law. What I've done here is take samples at 20-year intervals. For the years 1546-47, for the years 1567-68, and then I tried to do it again for 1587-1588 to see if I could trace any kind of change in the work of the court as the century progressed. This was made a little bit more difficult in that the early records from the 1540s are quite complete, but as the century goes on, the protocols become briefer and more standardized, so that by the end of the century, it's difficult to tell exactly what was going on before the underneath the official formulations that the court used. In 1546, in cases where a betrothal was claimed and found by the court to be invalid, 18 cases were filed by men, and 36 cases were filed by women. Although the betrothal was found not to exist, 17 of the women were reserved the right to sue the man for having caused a pregnancy. The following year, 1547, there were 21 cases filed by men, 51 filed by women, 19 of whom were pregnant and who were reserved the right to sue. If you skip 20 years, in 1567, you have 17 cases filed by men, 43 filed by women. Only 5 of them made any mention that she was pregnant, but by this time, your formulations are shrinking. 1568, you have 22 cases filed by men, 31 filed by women, 6 of whom said that they were pregnant. And by the time you got to 1587, 1588, there was no mention made at all of pregnancy one way or the other, so I couldn't get any kind of comparable statistics out of the data. Now, if you leave out those cases where the hopeful fiancé was pregnant, the motivation for which is fairly obvious, I think, the remainder of the cases attempting to enforce the existence of a legally valid betrothal are filed almost evenly by men and women. In most of these cases, there is absolutely no indication given in the summaries of the motivation for filing the suit. So we can only speculate whether unrequited love or possible economic advantage to be obtained from the match or something else led the aggrieved party into court. Clearly, however, breach of promise activity was far from the province of the woman alone. And interestingly enough, there were a couple of cases filed by the man when the girl was pregnant and refusing to get married, in which he was trying to get the court to coerce her into matrimony, and she was energetically defending herself from wanting to get into what apparently she regarded as an unpleasant trap. Once one went beyond this, you get to aspects of the activity of the Ehegericht which necessarily involve both the man and the woman simultaneously. 16% of the cases that came before the court involved petitions for dispensation allowing marriage within the prohibited degrees of consanguinity and affinity. And these petitions necessarily were brought by both parties to the proposed match. And I'll start by saying that the great majority of these requests were denied. This area is clearly one in which the commitment of the Württemberg Eheordnung and of the theologians and the lawyers who were administering it to the continued tradition of medieval canon law, prohibitions on affinity and consanguinity, was not at all understood or approved by the population who were living under the regulations. Clearly, from the petitions and from the witnesses and from the requests, in the minds of most Württembergers, there was no good reason why a man should not be allowed to marry his second or third cousin. There was even less reason why he should not be allowed to marry a sister or cousin of his deceased wife, and that many of the men felt that there were quite compelling reasons why he should be, particularly in the light of your discussion of the step-parent, that this would be the most loving step-parent he could possibly find for the children of the first marriage, someone who was related to them as aunt or cousin, knew them already, and would cherish them just as much as a natural mother would have done. And therefore, in spite of the steady stream of denials by the court, these petitions occurred with great regularity. 2% of the cases that came before the court were calls for declaration of nullity, And these were not of any particular pattern. Most of them were cases of impotence on the part of one or the other spouse for having sexual intercourse. This leaves us with divorce cases, which came in at 28% of the total. And I have here, before I get into them, a chart which I want to distribute. The total number of divorce cases that came in were 1,089. A statistical breakdown of the total number of divorce cases handled by the court from this period in the 16th century. Divorce on grounds of desertion with permission to remarry was 70.7% of the total. Divorce because of adultery, in 67 cases, the adultery being combined with desertion, was 21.1% of the total. Divorce without any grounds listed in the protocol covers 2%, and I tend to feel that whoever was court reporter simply forgot to write it down. Separation from bed and board was very rare, 0.6%, and rejected petitions for divorce in which the parties were admonished to go back home and live in peace with one another was 5.6%. Now, dealing with this kind of court record on divorce is not the easiest thing to do. First of all, you have to realize that as the Württemberg Ehegericht recognized adultery and desertion as the only valid grounds for divorce, necessarily all petitions for divorce were based either on adultery or desertion. Cast your mind to the experience, say, of the state of New York when adultery was the only valid grounds for divorce. And you can realize that under many of these petitions, there may well have been some kind of collusion. Couples who, for some reason, wanted a divorce and were coming into court with what seemed to be valid reasons to them. Most of the rejected petitions for divorce were rejected by the court on the grounds that there was not here a real desertion, but what they call a quasi-desertion, collusion. The couple had separated by mutual consent, and one of them was just claiming to have been deserted by the other. And they were very careful, if they possibly could get any evidence, not to let them get away with it. So this, I do warn you, necessarily all the cases were brought under those two categories. The bare statistics also are somewhat misleading. Of the 770 cases of desertion, quote unquote, 112 were brought by women whose husbands were missing in action in war or otherwise said to be dead. In other words, in these cases, the women were using the divorce procedure of the Eyolf Ordnung as the equivalent of what today would be an action to have a person declared legally dead and be able to go ahead and remarry. They were, in other words, finding a way to use the court that was probably not envisioned by the authorities who established it, as far as one can look at the legislative history. For them, it provided a kind of defense in case the husband who was presumed dead unexpectedly returned, because the procedures of the Ehegericht forbade an accusation of adultery from being brought against a woman who had been validly divorced. If she had divorced her husband for desertion first, he could not return and accuse her of adultery if, in fact, he was alive. Equally interestingly enough, though slightly off the topic, under the procedures of the Ehegericht, a woman who had been raped could not be divorced for adultery. A woman who had been misled into believing that another man was her husband could not be divorced for adultery. If he had sneaked into the bedroom at night and said, "Hi, honey, I'm home from my business trip," this did not count as adultery if she had thought that was her husband in the dark. You get some very interesting testimony on cases one way or the other. This chart that you have here is based on those petitions for divorce which appear to have been genuine petitions for divorce as compared to this declaration of someone being dead, etc., and so forth. Here again, the summaries for the 1540s are much fuller than those of later date. You will note, first of all, that the divorce is almost always coupled, both for a man and for a woman, with the right to remarry. 1544, 8 divorces filed by women, 8 women with right of remarriage. 6 divorces filed by men, 6 cases where the man had the right to remarry. And this is pretty consistent. The only exception I found to this was under 1568, in which year there was only one divorce case filed by a man, but there was one case in which both husband and wife were granted the right to remarry. This was the only case in the entire records of the Ehegericht where both parties were granted the right to remarry, and this case was so long, so complicated, so tangled, and so full of contradictory testimony that as far as I could tell, the judges just threw up their hands and said in resignation, "You are both divorced, you are both innocent, go away and never darken our doors again." But this was the only case. This case, by the way, was filed by the wife against her husband, who did not wish to be divorced one way or the other. The right to remarry was almost always granted after a year and a day. The decree would not be valid if the couple reconciled within that year and a day, and the court obviously would have preferred, if it could possibly arrange it, for such reconciliations to take place. Sometimes the year and a day was coupled with the requirement of a year and a day of good behavior on the part of the plaintiff before the provision would come into force. Not consistently, but on occasion. And I think that this year and a day of good behavior was frequently imposed by the judges where they were of the opinion that neither party was entirely guiltless. It was more or less automatically imposed when it was the woman who was going to remarry, just to make sure that she was not pregnant from the marriage, because then the question would, of course, have been who was going to support the child. If she was pregnant from the marriage, the divorced husband was going to have to ante up child support. And you can look at this. Now, a number of conclusions can be drawn from these records. Women, first of all, come into the divorce court as plaintiffs more often than do men. They are much more likely than men to allege desertion as the grounds for divorce. When a woman mentions adultery, it is almost always in connection with desertion. And this leads me to think that a woman in Wittenberg in the 16th century would very rarely have felt compelled to divorce her husband for adultery unless his passion for the other woman had led him to abandon his wife. If he was willing to stay home and support the family, apparently by and large, she was willing to put up with it. On the other hand, if a man's suit mentions desertion, it is usually only secondarily coupled with adultery. There's only one case I came across where a woman had deserted her husband without running off with another man. Only in one case had she merely absconded. Where husbands are concerned, however, there seem to be many cases of simple desertion. That is, husbands often deserted their wives without complicating the issue by committing adultery as well. A female plaintiff is just as likely as a male to be granted the right to remarry. A male adulterer is adjudged in Straf as regularly as an adulteress. And indeed, as far as one can tell, the Ehegericht administered the law with strict impartiality as to sex, given the variations of social custom that were outside the direct purview of the court. The same is true if you look at violations of the Eheordnung other than adultery. In 1547, 14 men were in Straf, 22 women were in Straf, and in 14 cases, both partners were in Straf for having done something or the other that violated the Eheordnung. There's a slight preponderance of women, but not a great discrepancy. Overall, for a territory the size of Württemberg, the number of cases that reached the Ehegericht simply was not very large. If you look at it, the fact that a woman's adultery was not treated any more severely than that of a husband, the granting of right to remarriage. And if you combine this, looking at the criminal code and the civil code with the limitations on a man's free use of his property if his extravagance threatened the family, with the willingness of the local authorities to put a man under bond to prevent domestic violence, and the fact that these rights are not merely theoretical but are actually being enforced in the courts, I think it would seem well to investigate a little more thoroughly than has been done whether or not the legal status of women in the 16th century was not considerably better secured by numbers of the continental law codes than it was under the English common law, with which a lot of American historians of women have tended to use as a touchstone.
Continue. continuing our transition from the ideal to the real, we have the presentation by Professor Thomas Safely on marriage litigation in the Diocese of Constance. Professor Safely is about to receive his PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He received a BA from Grinnell College and is presently teaching at George Washington University. When Mary Wood asked me to contribute a paper for this session, I was knee-deep in computer printouts and Polaroid cards. Of course, somewhat vainly and greedily, I leaped at the opportunity, and as soon as I hung up the phone, a saner voice asked me what all of these statistics could possibly have to do with attitudes toward marriage. Well, if time brings wisdom, time and experience, and that certainly is to be hoped, then I have come to be convinced that a particularly rich source, both for the history of church institutions and for the history of marriage in the 16th and 17th centuries, are the protocols of dioceses and tribunals. In Catholic territories, such as the Diocese of Constance in southwestern Germany and northern Switzerland, the resident bishop held unique legal competence in all questions and disputes regarding the validity and legality of a marital agreement. The officialis, the ecclesiastical judge appointed by the bishop and presiding over his tribunal in the name and with the legal personality of his prelate, heard all such litigation. And the records of his court may provide a factual basis for the study of marital attitudes among a broad segment of the Catholic laity and in the legal apparatus of the Catholic Church itself. The tribunal, or officialat, of the Diocese of Constance was remarkably active in the field of marriage litigation between 1551 and 1620. It resolved 11,778 marital disputes in that span of years, approximately 97.8% of its total caseload. The resulting legal records afford profound insights, in my opinion, into marital dysfunction and jurisprudence in a Catholic court of law. From an analysis of court function, patterns of activity and change over time become clear and contribute to the comparative social and psychological history of marriage in early modern Europe. Of these 11,778 cases, 48.3% concerned the existence or non-existence of a valid and legal marital contract. Restitution for damages and loss resulting from sexual relations before marriage were sought in 33.7% of the cases. Marital impediments were at issue in 12% of the procedures. Judicial separations and impotency comprised a further 3.2%, while morals offenses appeared only 2.0% of the time. The initial definition of the officialat as a marital court needs to be refined, therefore. It was rather a premarital court with the majority of its cases involving contract disputes. While the intimate details of conjugal relationships are missing, the protocols provide information on the gender and marital status of the litigants, reinforcing and extending the description of the ecclesiastical court at Constance as a premarital contract court. Of all plaintiffs, 63.2% were single females, more than twice the number of single males. Married persons, male or female, initiated litigation concerning marital disputes on only 80 occasions between 1551 and 1620. It would seem, therefore, that this tribunal was a women's court, an institution in which the vast majority of persons seeking legal redress and assistance were unmarried females. The degree of success and satisfaction enjoyed by plaintiffs before the officialat is somewhat more debatable. Throughout the 70-year period, there was a marked inclination on the part of the ecclesiastical judges to rule against disputed marital agreements. For example, in cases seeking the enforcement of an alleged marital contract, petitions were rejected in 94.1% of all instances. Over the entire range of its marital competence, the court acted to separate parties in more than 70% of the proceedings. While restitution, when sought, was usually granted, the fact remains that most plaintiffs
seeking the enforcement of a marital agreement at Constance were frustrated in their efforts by the court. On the basis of these major findings, two observations may be offered tentatively. In the Diocese of Constance between 1551 and 1620, the Catholic laity experienced considerable uncertainty as to the nature of a valid and legal marriage agreement. This confusion, resulting in disputable contracts, generated a large volume of marriage litigation. Furthermore, in instances of questionable agreements, the Catholic ecclesiastical authorities did not hesitate to separate the parties. By so doing, they sacrificed the value of monogamy for couples who were, at least in the perception of the laity, de facto married. Changes in marital attitudes and practices over time should serve to illuminate the efficacy of Catholic reform and, by so doing, further define the nature of these phenomena. By studying annual variation in court activity between 1551 and 1620, it becomes clear immediately that the officialate of Constance was undergoing profound changes, changes that reflect the theory and practice of marriage in the Catholic community. A secular decline in the number of cases heard at Constance is apparent over the entire 70-year period. Despite individual periods of activity or inactivity, the general pattern of court function is one of decreased usage from a maximum of 455 proceedings in 1556 to a minimum of 53 in 1610. The decline, interestingly enough, did not begin in earnest until 1568, just 1 year after the publication of the Tridentine decrees throughout the diocese. Once started, however, the downward trend continued until 1610. After 1610, there's some indication of renewed activity based on a slight rise in cases of impediments and separations, but figures are too small, a peak of 120 in 1618, and too late in the period of study to encourage certainty. The decline is reflected in every type of marital litigation. Cases seeking the enforcement of a marital contract dropped from a level of 197 proceedings in 1556 to 16 in 1620. Other types of marital disputes resolved at Constance all show a similar pattern of change, at least through 1610. Therefore, the decline in court activity was not relative or compositional, but absolute. Likewise, the decline of the officialate was not related to changes in the court's geographic jurisdiction or its effective authority. To deal with the latter first, the period after the Council of Trent, which made the tribunal the unique court of first instance for all disputes within the ecclesiastical competence, should have been marked by increased vigor and activity on the part of the officialate. No extant documents suggest administrative or institutional changes that might explain the noted decline. The officialate was and remained the ecclesiastical court of first instance for the entire diocese. An analysis of the frequency with which certain place names appear in the protocols was undertaken to establish any alteration either in the geographic limits of court authority or in the ability of the court to project its competence and attract litigation. Only the nearest rural chapters, Constance included, and those within 15 kilometers of it, and the farthest, those more than 85 kilometers distant, were underrepresented. The majority of cases within the sample originated from rural chapters of intermediate distances, 15 to 85 kilometers from the diocesan see. Furthermore, there was no noteworthy change in this relationship between distance and volume of litigation during the period of study. The reduction of case volume was distributed evenly in the diocese. Declining court activity was not, therefore, a result of any change in jurisdiction or legal authority. External causes for the decline of the Constance officialate as a marriage court must be sought given the lack of positive evidence from within the institution. Fewer marital disputes were being brought to the tribunal. Two hypotheses may explain the cause. First, it is possible that the reforms implemented in marriage law and diocesan legal authority by the Council of Trent were effective in reducing the volume of disputes. According to this reasoning, the Catholic Church triumphed in its efforts to end clandestine marriages and to educate the laity in the definition and legal nature of marriage between 1551 and 1620 as it had not succeeded in the Middle Ages. Second, the Tridentine legal reforms, while effective in reestablishing episcopal authority within the local diocese, were unsuited to the marital needs of the broad spectrum of Catholic lay society. If the laity perceived Catholic marital law as ineffective, expensive, or uncongenial, solutions to problems of this sort would have been sought outside the bishop's court. The character and procedures of the officialate may have exercised an influence over the behavior of individuals as well. It seems reasonable to speculate that a distant court of law, staffed by strangers and executing an unfamiliar code in a foreign language, could have alienated potential and actual litigants even further. As a result, court activity would have declined. The decline in contract litigation before the Tribunal of Constance suggests strongly that the Council of Trent enjoyed a modicum of success. The clarity and force of the decree Temetzi probably worked to reduce the frequency of clandestine marriages. Likewise, the ceremony required to enter a valid and legal marriage gradually ended the misunderstanding so much in evidence before the reforms. Contract disputes grew increasingly rare in the officialate. To test the second hypothesis, secular or extra-legal solutions to marital disputes were being sought by the laity with increasing frequency from 1551 to 1620, an evaluation of morals and marital offenses tried by a municipal court in the Diocese of Constance was undertaken. Freiburg im Breisgau, a city approximately 100 kilometers northwest from Constance, possesses unusually complete judicial records from the 16th and 17th centuries. The jurisdictions and competences of secular and religious courts in early modern Europe were, to a certain extent, distinct. On the other hand, municipal courts adjudicated breaches of public order and morality between husbands and wives that reflect the stability and discipline of marriage in urban Catholic society. A police court, the Stadtgericht zu Freiburg, served as a forum in which the civic magistracy could accuse and prosecute criminals and disturbers of the social order. Between 1551 and 1620, the levels of adultery, bigamy, repudiation, and spouse beating rose gradually in Freiburg. It is of further interest that the majority of defendants in these cases were men, 75% of the total. This fact reflects and supports the notion that women and the courts acted in unison, each for their own quite distinct reasons, to defend and preserve domestic stability. Questions may be raised, certainly, about the extent to which one city in a diocese is representative of the entire episcopal territory, much less other cities located in it. Yet the frequency of marital dysfunction as a secular problem suggests strongly that marital discipline among the laity was not improved by Catholic religious reforms. Disaffection with ecclesiastical marriage law may have prompted individuals to seek extra-legal or illegal solutions to their marital problems. Likewise, individuals may have been forced to tolerate less than congenial marriages. If such was indeed the case, it implies resistance, in certain groups at least, to the Church's model and control of marriage. This sketch of ecclesiastical court functions in the Diocese of Constance poses both questions and answers. The character of the officialate as a marriage contract court seems beyond dispute. That most litigants were single, and that more than 50% of all disputes concerned the existence or non-existence of a valid agreement proved the confusion and difficulty experienced by the laity in the establishment of marriage contracts. Likewise, the church court served as a refuge for women. They sought aid and redress in court despite their dependent legal status twice as often as men. It seems clear that women and ecclesiastical jurists found themselves unintentionally allied in court. Bound by the social horizons of household and family, most women could exercise few options against their husbands other than seeking legal restoration of their conjugal rights. The religious magistracy, on the other hand, supported these legal efforts to the extent of granting restitution or dissolution, though not by enforcing a marital agreement, as a result of their conviction that a stable domestic life was the foundation of stable society. Most importantly, the decline in court activity between 1551 and 1620 bespeaks changes in marital attitudes and practices. Cases involving contract interpretation declined without exception, but some evidence indicates a slight resurgence of impediment and separation proceedings in the second decade of the 1600s. This most consequential finding was a result both of the triumph and failure of Catholic marital doctrine. The Council of Trent moved decisively to establish the competence of the Catholic Church in the spiritual elements of marriage. By so doing, it reinforced its marital model based on monogamy and exogamy. After centuries of local resistance, there is some evidence that popular attitudes and practices may have begun to shift gradually in the 16th and 17th centuries under the pressure of clear doctrine that decreed temetsi in particular and education. The decline in contractual disputes reflects this phenomenon most clearly. The tentative rise in annulments and separations, taken in conjunction with the secular evidence gathered in Freiburg, on the other hand, may represent a fundamental departure from Catholic teaching by the laity. With no positive evidence of a change in diocesan legal authority, these transitions may indicate a more secular, though not irreligious, view of the marriage among the laity, a view of the union as temporal, transient, and dissoluble. The decrees of the Council of Trent gave most attention to the legal form of marriage and less to its personal content. The canons of Sessio 24 were intended to improve discipline among the faithful and to enunciate the Catholic theology of marriage in a final, unmistakable form. Accordingly, marriage was a sacrament, a spiritual as well as a temporal bond, and once established, indissoluble. Yet for the laity, the context of marriage involved the union of persons, families, and property in a psychological, social, and economic environment. It was a worldly arrangement, requiring perhaps more flexibility than is revealed in the protocols, despite the readiness of the officiales to sacrifice monogamy by absolving contracts or granting annulments. Changes in court function seem to indicate an acceptance on the part of the laity of the religio-legal formality of marriage required by the Catholic Church. At the same time, however, they experienced a growing conviction that marriage, while not lacking in religious significance, was essentially private and temporal.
We conclude our formal presentations of this session with a comment from Professor Mary Wood of Augustana College, who is most responsible for this session. Professor Wood received her BA from Grinnell College and her PhD in 1979 from the University of Wisconsin.
Perhaps a better title of the session, as I've heard the papers might have been Marriage in Theory and Practice, which seems to be somewhat a different kind of theory, is somewhat different from practice. But I think from all three of the papers, we can see some similarities as well as some very distinct differences. One thing that certainly comes out is a tremendous concern on the part of all levels of government and church leaders, both Catholic and Protestant, with the family as a social institution, or the social institution. Both Catholics and Protestants see marriage and the family as central to society. One wonders what happened to the ideal of celibacy. It's clearly seen as much more than simply a property agreement, even if it's also clearly recognized that marriage was entered into primarily as a property agreement. This did not extend, however, as Tom Safer points out, to an effort to bring families or keep families or couples together in which one party was clearly being wronged, either in Protestant areas by desertion or adultery, or in most areas by contracts that were never really entered into. This, however, was usually accompanied by an allowance of remarriage for the wronged spouse, along with an encouragement of remarriage, although some recognition sometimes of the problems that remarriage could involve. I know in the city of Nuremberg, the city council decreed that no one should remarry until they were at least no longer pregnant with the child by the first husband. It had all sorts of problems when you had a child by your first husband while married to a second husband. But I think that it's very unclear whether this protection of the family was perceived at any point to be a protection of women as a social group, as Professor Demars would like to extend it. It often resulted in supporting women, certainly in the Catholic cases, women against their husbands in alliance with ecclesiastical judges, but the motivations of the theorists and the courts, I think, can't be overlooked when you're trying to look at this. Those are my comments on all three of them together. Now I have sort of specific comments. First to Professor Miller's paper, and I'll sort of run through all of these, and then you can either respond
or we can take things from the audience, I guess. Spangenberg's tract, the Eheschwegel, seems to belie much as that is normally said about the early modern family, Arias and Lord Stone and other people, you know, that people did not become emotionally involved with their children, that the family unit was cold, the family was essentially a living group rather than a kind of emotional group. This seems to be supported also by work done by Michael McDonald, who's now at the University of Wisconsin, in his study of psychiatric cases of melancholy and depression of an English physician. He finds that, McDonald finds that many women were terribly upset and distraught over the death or illness of their children. They become enormously depressed and almost suicidal. But I think there are some problems as well with Professor Miller's paper, particularly in using any kind of Spiegel literature as descriptive rather than prescriptive. It's as things ought to be rather than as they are. And I think, too, that to extend an emotional attachment to their children, I'm quoting now, to mean a sympathetic appreciation for childhood. Childhood is a rather modern conception and a rather modern term. Any real consciousness of childhood as a separate state of being or state of development in the 16th century might be a little premature. I also, myself, was confused in reading the paper and hearing the paper again about whether Professor Miller feels that Spangenberg's attitude refutes or supports Arias. It seems at one point that he's saying that Spangenberg is basically medieval in outlook. He's suggesting don't get so upset at the death of your children, dealing with people who are more modern, who are themselves extremely distraught in their reactions to children's death. But that would hardly seem to make him someone who, again, I'm quoting Professor Miller, is, quote, more than many of his contemporaries, he seems to have a genuine understanding for and appreciation of the situation of his parishioners. Now, perhaps Spangenberg is also confused about what the proper attitude toward the death of children should be as well, whether one should be thankful that they've gone on to heaven or upset that they have left this world. Those are just sort of general comments. It also leads to a number of other questions, of course, too. And I'll be very interested to see Professor Miller's dissertation and book, and that my immediate reaction was, how does Spangenberg depart from Luther? What's the difference that you can see in early 16th century as opposed to later 16th century marriage literature? And also whether you feel that any of these idealizations that the Protestant theorists come up with are reflected in Protestant or specifically Lutheran marriage legislation. How do they implement them, or do they attempt to implement them at all in what the courts are doing? Okay. There's Professor DeMars. As with Professor Safely, we see the difference very clearly between the official conception of what marriage was and a popular conception. They seem to be two, in many ways, different kinds of things. She points out as well the problem, as with modern sociologists too, of ascertaining what the percentages or the levels of anything like desertion or violence were, or adultery or anything like that as well. I, again, getting back to this question of theory versus reality, would like to see what the Ehegericht uses as the grounds for its decisions. Does it refer back to the Bible all the time, to church fathers, to tradition, to legal codes? Does it talk about Protestant pamphlets? What kinds of things does it refer to? A comment I would make on the fact, as she points out, that the wife's desertion was always coupled with adultery. I don't find that at all surprising. What would she have done if she deserted him alone? She would have gone off and probably been a prostitute. That would have been her single kind of option. There's really no other little independent employment opportunities. No fear to even travel from town to town except for a prostitute. So she just couldn't have left the town and done something else. I'm also curious about statistics about children in the cases of desertion. Does the presence of children inhibit desertion at all, which one would assume following Professor Miller's arguments about the importance of children in the life? The conclusion, I too find, might be perhaps a bit too sweeping, again, getting back to the question of whether any
support of the family can really be used as an idea of the support of women. Whether one suspects that there were more unreported cases of male adultery or violence compared to female, again, given the lack of other options for women, they have to put up with it. Professor Stathis' paper points out some interesting contrasts between Catholic and Protestant church courts. Other than a very expected lack of divorce cases, we find many more women than men, even in breach of promise suits. Absolutely no desertion cases, and this is my own ignorance coming in here. Is desertion not a grounds for the possibility of divorce or separation in Catholic doctrine? Okay. But also in his longer paper, indicates that there were 75% of the cases for separation of bread and board brought about by adultery were successful. One wonders perhaps why there were so few still, why more women did not bring these kinds of things. Again, probably there a bit women's inability to economically succeed without a husband leads to this kind of thing. I also would be interested in what you'd speculate or know to be the difference in pre- and post-Trent handling of these kinds of cases. I have two general conclusions to make about all these. The reassertion of the ideal, the importance of the nuclear family, is often tied in, seen as tied in with the Reformation, especially with Puritanism. You see the Puritan championing of a nuclear family. And I'm wondering if what we're hearing in Catholic areas, if this is not a general trend of the 16th century and is not necessarily the result of religious change, but perhaps an economic change more. And the final conclusion, if you assume that an aegrate, a consistorium, the Catholic church courts, etc., were operating with some kind of ideal in mind, which may be assuming too much, do their decisions or actions at all work to implement their ideal? Or are they really more prohibitive?
Thank you. Whatever happened to celibacy, it was vigorously defended in the Catholic polemics of the second half of the 16th century, and very few Protestants, if any, in their treatises on marriage, rejected the idea of true celibacy. We have time for comments and questions. You can direct your questions as freely as you wish to any members of the session.
Very expensive. solely with the, say, the existence or non-existence, or probably somewhat less, because it's a small body of litigation in which a person would come to the court essentially and say, this contract doesn't exist, and instead of wishing to have this enforced, would wish to have it publicly dissolved, but very close to 50% of the total body of litigation. Actually, I hear a number of questions or observations in what you say as regards to the type of people, the level of the Catholic society involved. It's very, very difficult, at least from the strict records, to get an idea of who is actually appearing. You get a certain occurrence of honorific titles, magistrates only, it's difficult to understand just exactly what is intended by these, and it's my own conviction based on my work with the Protestant records, as well as at Freiburg and with the Protestant court in Basel, that this is really very broadly representative of the society as a whole. You might get an underrepresentation of the greatest and least members of the society. They tend to appear somewhat less than one might expect. But it's very difficult to know if your percentages differ significantly from the composition of the society per se. That is, that this kind of broad middle strata would, of course, be the most populous part of the society. Therefore, they would tend to be overrepresented. And my conclusion on the matter that, in fact, you would get just about everybody sooner or later pursuing their rights, often in spite of the cost. And that is in itself, I think, a noteworthy observation.
Time for one more question.
Director to Professor Miller, in regard to the distinction or the contrast to a period of practice here, in Funders in the field, did you find an undercurrent of dissatisfaction with the state of marriage as it was in the 1700s?
particularly, I don't think that Eschwege's a collection of sermons which he delivered, their marital sermons. And so in each instance, there was an occasion for the sermon to be delivered. And I don't detect any tension with these pictures with it all. It's certainly an interesting question I can't really respond to from Judge Bonnet.
We stand adjourned. Thank you.